The candidate does not have to leap through the roof. A stool is left him, so that he can climb out of the pit where he has remained for 7 days. He must crawl out through the square hole in the side of the cell. The size of this hole is calculated in proportion to the span between the second finger and thumb of the candidate's hand. He who succeeds is qualified to become Maik Tang. It is difficult to understand that a training which compels a man to remain motionless for years can result in the acquisition of peculiar swiftness. However, this is the special training of Shaolu, and in other places we meet with different and apparently more rational methods, including the actual practice of marching. Moreover, it must be understood that the Lungam method does not aim at training the disciple by strengthening his muscles, but by developing in him psychic states that make these extraordinary marches possible. The Makatang starts on the 11th day of the 10th month of the Tibetan year semicolon corresponding to November. After visiting Lhasa, Same, and several other places, he is back at Shaolu on the 25th of the same month. He immediately sets out again, goes to Shigatse, makes an extended tour in the highlands of Tsang, Tsang Tod, and returns to Shaolu after 1 month's time. Then the lineal successor of Bustan performs the propitiation rites, as Makatang's invitations to the demons are, apparently, always accepted without demur. I, by chance, caught a glimpse of another Lungampa in the region inhabited by some independent tribes of Tibetan origin in the Sichuanese far west. But this time I had not the opportunity of watching him tramp. We were traveling in a forest, Yongdan and I walking ahead of our servants and beasts, when at the turning of the path, we came upon a naked man with iron chains rolled all round his body. He was seated on a rock and seemed so deeply buried in thoughts that he had not heard us coming. We stopped, astonished, but he must have suddenly become aware of our presence. For after gazing at us a moment, he jumped up and threw himself into the thickets more quickly than a deer. For a while we heard the noise of the chains jingling on his body growing rapidly fainter and fainter, then all was silence again. "That man is a Lungampa," said Yongdan to me. "I have already seen one like him. They wear these chains to make themselves heavy, for through the practice of Lungam, their bodies have become so light that they are always in danger of floating in the air." My third meeting with a Lungampa happened in Ga, a region of Kham, in eastern Tibet. I was again traveling with my small caravan. The man appeared under the familiar and commonplace figure of an Arjopa, that is to say a poor pilgrim carrying his luggage on his back. Thousands of such fellows may be seen on all the tracks of Tibet, so we did not pay much attention to a member of such a large tribe. These needy, solitary pedestrians have the habit of attaching themselves to any trader's caravan or to any rich traveler whom they happen to meet on their way and following them. They walk beside the pack animals, or if these are few and lightly loaded, so that they trot together with the riders. The beggars who, of course, fall behind, tramp until they join the party at the evening camping. This is not generally difficult, for during long journeys Tibetans start at daybreak and stop at about midday in order that their beasts may rest and graze during the whole afternoon. The trouble that the Arjopa gives himself to hurry after the horseman, or any odd help he is always ready to give the servants, are rewarded by a daily evening meal and occasional buttered tea and tsampa from the travelers themselves. According to this custom, the man whom we had met attached himself to our party. We learned from him that he had been staying at the Pabong Monastery in Kham, and was going to the Tsang province. A pretty long journey which, done on foot and begging on the way, would take 3 or 4 months. However, such tramps are undertaken by thousands of Tibetan pilgrims. Our companion had already spent a few days with us when, in consequence of a slight breakdown, it was nearly noon before we started. Thinking that the pack mules would be late in crossing a ridge that lay ahead of us, I rode on with my son and a servant, to look for water and a grassy place where we could camp before dusk. When the master travels ahead, the man who accompanies him always carries a vessel to make tea and some provisions, so that the gentleman or the lama may have a meal while waiting for the arrival of the luggage and tents. My servant had not failed to comply with this habit, and it was this point so trivial in itself which caused the display of the lung impa's abilities. The wait of the pass was longer than I had suspected, and I soon realized that the pack mules would not reach the top of the ridge before nightfall. It was out of the question to let them attempt going down the other side of the range in the dark, so having reached a grassy spot near a brooklet, I stopped there. We had already drank tea and were collecting dry cow dung to feed the fire 166. With the exception of woody regions, the cattle dung is the only fuel used in Tibet. In the parts of the country inhabited by Dokpas, travelers collect what is left by the animals on the pasture grounds to light their campfire. 166. When I saw the Ajapa climbing the slope at some distance below us, progressing with extraordinary rapidity. As he came nearer, I could see that he was walking with the same peculiar nimble springing gait which I had noticed in the Lama Lungampa of Thebjai. When he reached us, the man stood quite still for a while, staring straight before him. He was not at all out of breath, but appeared only half conscious and incapable of speaking or moving. However, the trance gradually subsided and the Ajapa came back to his normal state. Answering my questions, he told me that he had begun the Lungam training for acquiring fleetness with a Gomchen who lived near the Pabong Monastery. His master having left the country, he intended to go to Shalagompa in Tsang. He did not tell me any more and looked sad the whole evening. On the morrow, he confessed to Yongden that the trance had come on him involuntarily and had been produced by a most vulgar thought. As he was walking along with the servants who led my mules, he had begun to feel impatient. They were going so slowly, he thought, and during that time we were, no doubt, grilling on the fire the meat he had seen my servant carry with him. When the three other servants and he himself would have overtaken us, they would have to pitch the tents, to look after the beasts, and so there would only be time to drink tea and eat tsampa before retiring to sleep. He visualized our little party, he saw the fire, the meat on the red embers, and sunk in contemplation gradually became unconscious of his surroundings. Then, prompted by the desire of sharing our meal, he accelerated his pace and in so doing mechanically fell into the special gait which he was learning. The habitual association of that peculiar gait with the mystic words his master had taught him, caused the mental recitation of the proper formula. The latter led to the regulation of the breath in the prescribed rhythm, and the trance followed. Nevertheless, the concentration of his thoughts on the grilled meat dominated everything. The novice regarded himself as a sinner. The mixture of gluttony, holy mystic words and lungam exercises seemed to him sacrilegious. My Lama son did not fail to report the confidences he had received. I felt interested and put different questions to the novice. He was most unwilling to answer, but I managed to obtain some information which confirmed what I knew already. He had been told that sunset and clear nights were favorable conditions for the walker. He had also been advised to train himself by looking fixedly at the starry sky. I suppose that, like most Tibetan mystics, he had taken an oath not to divulge the teaching imparted by his master and that my questions troubled him. The third day after his racing performance, when we awoke, at daybreak, he was no longer in the tents. He had fled at night, perhaps using his power of lungam and, this time, for a more worthy purpose than that of sharing a bon bouch. The information which I obtained from different sources regarding the peculiar practice of lungam may be summarized as follows. The first step before undertaking the training is, as usual, to acquire power by the Angkhya rite. One must then, under the guidance of an experienced teacher, drill oneself for several years in various kinds of breathing exercises. It is only when the disciple has acquired a sufficient degree of proficiency that he is permitted to attempt the racing performance itself. A new Angkhya is conferred at this stage and a mystic formula, imparted by the master to the novice. The latter is advised to concentrate his thoughts on the cadenced mental recitation of that formula with which, during his walk, the in and out breathing must be in rhythm, the steps keeping time with the breath and the syllables of the formula. The walker must neither speak, nor look from side to side. He must keep his eyes fixed on a single distant object and never allow his attention to be attracted by anything else. When the trance has been reached, though normal consciousness is for the greater part suppressed, it remains sufficiently alive to keep the man aware of the obstacles in his way, and mindful of his direction and goal. Wide desert spaces, flat ground, and especially evening twilight are said to be favorable conditions. Even if one has already made a long tramp during the day and feels tired, the trance is often easily attained at sunset. Fatigue is then no longer felt and the traveler can continue walking for miles. The first hours of the day are also favorable, but in a lesser degree. Noon and early afternoon, narrow valleys, woodlands, uneven ground are considered unfavorable conditions and only adepts in Longam are deemed capable of overcoming the adverse influences which emanate from them. These explanations seem to imply that uniformity in the landscape and absence of nearby conspicuous objects are helpful in attaining the trance. It is certain that a wide, desert plain offers fewer occasions of distracting attention from the formula and the movement of the breath, than a ravine half obstructed with rocks and bushes, noisy mountain streams, etc. As for the regularity of the pace, it cannot be easily kept up on a rough uneven path. From my own superficial experience of the practice, though desert tablelands are choice ground, I feel convinced that a forest of tall straight trees, devoid of undergrowth and crossed by tolerably even paths, may be quite favorable to the trance, perhaps also on account of the uniformity of the landscape. However, this is my own idea and is based on a single personal observation which I made in the primeval forests of Poyul. Any clear night is deemed good for the training of beginners, but strong starlight is especially favorable. One is often advised to keep the eyes fixed on a particular star. This appears connected with hypnotic effects, and I have been told that among novices who train themselves in that way, some stop walking when their star sinks below the skyline or rises above their head. Others, on the contrary, do not notice its disappearance because, by the time that the star has passed out of sight, they have formed a subjective image of it which remains fixed before them. Some initiates in the secret lore also assert that, as a result of long years of practice, after he has traveled over a certain distance, the feet of the Longam Pa no longer touch the ground and that he glides on the air with an extreme celerity. Setting aside exaggeration, I am convinced from my limited experiences and what I have heard from trustworthy lamas, that one reaches a condition in which one does not feel the weight of one's body. A kind of anesthesia deadens the sensations that would be produced by knocking against the stones or other obstacles on the way, and one walks for hours at an unaccustomed speed, enjoying that kind of light agreeable dizziness well known to motorists at high speed. Tibetans distinguish between the regular prolonged tramps accomplished by the Longam Pa and those of the Powos-possessed mediums, who go into trances involuntarily and walk with no definite goal in view. Intellectual lamas do not deny the reality of the phenomena brought about, in the long run, by Longam practices, but they care little for them. Their attitude reminds us of that ascribed to the Buddha, in an old story. It is said that the Buddha was once journeying with some of his disciples and met an emaciated yogin, all alone in a hut in the middle of a forest. The master stopped and inquired how long the man had been living there, practicing austerities. 25 years, answered the yogin. And what power have you acquired by such long and arduous exertion? Asked the Buddha. I am able to cross a river by walking on the water, proudly replied the anchorite. My poor fellow, said the Buddha with commiseration. Have you really wasted so many years for such trifling result? Why, the ferryman will take you to the opposite bank for a small coin. The art of warming oneself without fire up in the snows to spend the winter in a cave amidst the snows, at an altitude that varies between 11,000 and 18,000 feet, clad in a thin garment or even naked, and escape freezing, is a somewhat difficult achievement. Yet numbers of Tibetan hermits go safely each year through this ordeal. Their endurance is ascribed to the power which they have acquired to generate tamo. The word tamo signifies heat, warmth, but is not used in Tibetan language to express ordinary heat or warmth. It is a technical term of mystic terminology, and the effects of that mysterious heat are not confined to warming the anchorites who can produce it. Tibetan adepts of the secret lore distinguish various kinds of tamo, exoteric tamo, which arises spontaneously in the course of peculiar raptures and, gradually, folds the mystic in the soft, warm mantle of the gods, esoteric tamo, that keeps the hermits comfortable on the snowy hills, mystic tamo, which can only claim a distant and quite figurative connection with the term warmth, for it is the experience of paradisiac bliss in this world. In the secret teaching, tamo is also the subtle fire which warms the generative fluid and drives the energy in it, till it runs all over the body along the tiny channels of the tsaz. Superstition and odd physiological ideas have contributed to give birth to many extraordinary stories on this subject, one of which I will venture to briefly relate. The famous ascetic, Rishungpa, anxious to become an erudite, left his master Milarepa, against the latter's advice, to study the philosophic literature at Lhasa. Lacking his spiritual father's blessing, things turned badly for him, at least from a religious point of view. A rich man became quite enthusiastic about the young lama's learning and mastery of occult lore and, in order to attach him to his house, he gave him his only child as wife. This happened before the reform of Tsongkhapa at a time when all lamas were allowed to marry. The girl did not in the least share her father's admiration for Rishungpa, but she was obliged to obey him, and in revenge made life rather hard for her poor husband, who might well regret having yielded to the attraction of wealth. His meekness in bearing ill treatment did not soften his wife's heart, she went so far as to stab him with a knife. And lo! Instead of blood, generative fluid ran out of the wound. By the practice of tamo, so said the lama who told me the story with absolute conviction, the body of Rishungpa had been filled with the seed of life. To do justice to Tibetans, I must add that another lama scoffed at the tale and thus explained it. Truly, through tamo practices one may fill one's body with generative force which allows psychic creations, but this is subtle, invisible energy. However, only a few, even in mystic circles, are thoroughly acquainted with these several kinds of tamo, while the wonderful effects of the tamo that warms and keeps alive the hermits in the snowy wilds are known to every Tibetan. It does not follow that the process by which that mysterious heat is produced is equally familiar to all of them. On the contrary, it is kept secret by the lamas who teach it, and they do not fail to declare that information gathered by hearsay or by reading is without any practical result if one has not been personally taught and trained by a master who is himself an adept. Moreover, only those who are qualified to undertake the training may hope to enjoy its fruit. The most important qualifications required are, to be already skilled in the various practices connected with breathing, to be capable of a perfect concentration of mind, going as far as the trance in which thoughts become visualized, and to have received the proper anchor from a lama possessed with the power of conferring it. Tamo initiation. Or more exactly and literally empowerment, anchor, the rite by which a peculiar power is communicated by the master to his disciple, is preceded by a long period of probation. Among other objects, I think probation aims at testing the robustness of the candidates. As great as may be my confidence in the tamo method, I still doubt whether it could be safely practiced by people of weak constitution. It is probable, however, that tamo's teachers, wisely, endeavor to avoid failures that might prove harmful to presumptuous disciples and lower their own repute. I do not know whether, when yielding to my pressing requests and shortening my time of probation, the venerable lama who empowered me only wanted to get rid of me or not. He simply told me to go to a lonely spot, to bathe there in an icy mountain stream, and then, without drying my body or putting on my clothes, to spend the night motionless in meditation. Winter had not yet begun, but the level of the place, about 10,000 feet high, made the night rather chilly, and I felt very proud of not catching cold. Later on I took another bath of the same kind, this time involuntarily, when I lost footing as I was fording the Mekong River, near Rakshi in northern Tibet. When I reached the shore, In a few minutes my clothes froze on me. I had no spare ones. One may easily understand that Tibetans, who are frequently exposed to accidents caused by a hard climate, hold a method that protects them against the cold in high esteem. Once initiated, one must renounce all fur or woolen clothing and never approach the fire to warm oneself. After a short period, during which he exerts himself under the close supervision of his master, the novice must retire to a very remote, absolutely solitary place situated high up on the hills. In Tibet, high up means generally an altitude well above 10,000 feet. According to Tummo teachers and adepts, one must never practice the training exercises inside a house, or near inhabited places. They believe that foul air produced by smoke and smells, together with various occult causes, impede the success of the student and may even harm him. Once conveniently settled, the disciple must see nobody besides his Lama, who may visit him occasionally, or to whose hermitage he may repair at long intervals. The novice must begin his training each day before dawn and finish the special exercise relating to Tummo before sunrise, because as a rule he has to perform one or another meditation at that time. The practice must be done in the open, and one must be either naked or clothed in a single cotton garment. Beginners may sit on a straw mat, if they own one, or on a piece of hard sackcloth or a wooden stool. More advanced disciples sit on the bare ground, and at a still higher degree of proficiency, on the snow or the ice of a frozen pond or stream. They must not breakfast or even drink anything, especially any hot drink, before practicing. Two postures are allowed. Either the usual meditation posture cross-legged or seated in Western fashion, each hand placed on the corresponding knee, the thumb, the forefinger and the little finger being extended, and the middle and fourth fingers bent under the palm. Various breathing drills are first performed which aim at clearing the passage of the air in the nostrils. Then pride, anger, hatred, covetousness, sloth, stupidity are mentally rejected with the rhythmic breathing out. All blessings from saintly beings, the Buddha's spirit, the five wisdoms, all that is good and lofty in the world are attracted and assimilated while drawing in the breath. Now, composing oneself for a while, one dismisses all cares and cogitations. Having become perfectly calm, one imagines that a golden lotus exists in one's body, on a level with the navel. In this lotus, shining like the sun, stands the syllable Ram. Above Ram is the syllable Ma. From Ma Dorje Naljorma 1.A feminine deity. Then, each deep inspiration is followed by a retention of the breath. Gradually the time spent holding in the breath is increased more and more. These mystic syllables, which are called seed, must not be regarded as mere written characters, or symbolic representations of things, but as living beings standing erect and endowed with motive power. For instance, Ram is not the mystic name of the fire, it is the seed of fire. Hindus attach great importance to the right pronunciation of these seed formulas. They think that their power resides in the sound which they believe to be creative. Certain Tibetan mystics agree that Ram correctly pronounced, may produce fire, yet these mystic syllables are not generally used in Tibet's sound, but rather as representations of elements, deities, etc. Tibetans identifying Ram with the fire, think that he who knows how to make mental use of the subjective image of that word, can set anything ablaze or even produce flames without apparent fuel. As soon as one has imagined Dorje Naljorma springing from the syllable Ma, one must identify oneself with her. When one has become the deity, one imagines the letter A placed in the navel and the letter Ha 175.A letter of the Tibetan alphabet. Slow, deep inspirations act as bellows and wake up a smoldering fire, the size and shape of a minute ball. One's thoughts continue to follow the waking up of fire which ascends along the Ama vein arising in the middle of the body. Tibetans have borrowed from India the three mystic Nadi. However, enlightened mystics consider that Sa system is devoid of any physical reality. According to their opinion, it is but symbolical imagery. The exercise goes on, through 10 stages, But one must understand that there exists no pause between them. The different subjective visions, as well as the sensations which accompany them, succeed each other in a series of gradual modifications. Inhalations, retentions of the breath and expirations continue rhythmically, and a mystic formula is continually repeated. The mind must remain perfectly concentrated and one-pointed on the vision of the fire and the sensation of warmth which ensues. The 10 stages may be briefly described as follows. 1. The central artery is imagined, and subjectively seen, as thin as the thinnest thread or as a hair, yet filled with the ascending flame and crossed by the current of air produced by the breath. 2. The artery has increased in size and become as large as the little finger. 3. It continues to increase and appears to be the size of an arm. 4. The artery fills the whole body, or rather the body has become the Tset self, a kind of tube filled with blazing fire and air. 5. The bodily form ceases to be perceived. Enlarged beyond all measure, the artery engulfs the whole world and the Naljorpa feels himself to be a storm-beaten flame among the glowing waves of an ocean of fire. Beginners whose mind has not yet acquired the habit of very protracted meditation go more quickly through these 5 stages than more advanced disciples, who progress slowly from one to another, sunk in deep contemplation. Yet, even the quickest ones take about an hour to reach the 5th stage. Now the subjective visions repeat themselves in reverse order. 6. The stormy wind abates. The fiery waves sink lower and are less agitated, the blazing ocean narrows and is absorbed in the body. 7. The artery, which is reduced to the size of an arm, is seen again with the fire enclosed in it. 8. The artery decreases to the size of the little finger. 9. It becomes as thin as a hair. 10. It entirely disappears. The fire ceases utterly to be perceived, as well as all forms, all representations whatsoever. All ideas of any kind of objects vanish likewise. The mind sinks into the great emptiness where the duality knower and the object perceived does not exist any longer. It is a trance which, according to the spiritual and psychic development of the Naljorpa, is more or less deep and more or less prolonged. The exercise, either with or without the 5 last stages, may be repeated during the day or whenever one is suffering from cold. But the training, properly speaking, is done during the early practice before dawn. It is probable that Mylarspa resorted to it when he happened to be unexpectedly surrounded by the snow in a cave of the Lakhi Kang, near the Mount Everest, and found himself compelled to stay there till the next spring. He made his adventure the subject of a poem, part of which is freely translated below. Disgusted with the worldly life sought solitude on the slopes of Lakhi Kang, heavens and earth having held a council, sent me the tempest as their messenger, the airy and watery elements associated with the southern dark clouds. They imprisoned the sun and the moon, blew the small stars away from the sky and shrouded the large ones in the mist. Then, it snowed continually for 9 days and nights. The biggest flakes were as big as the fleece of wool. They came down flying like birds. The small ones were the size of peas and mustard seeds. They came down rolling and whirling. The greatness of the snowfall was beyond all expression. High up it covered the crest of the glacier ranges, low down it buried, up to their tops, the trees of the forest. The black hills appeared to be whitewashed. The frost flattened the billowy lakes and the blue running streams were hidden under the ice. The mountains and the valleys were leveled and looked like a plain. Men were prisoners in the villages. Domestic animals suffered from famine, birds and wild beasts fasted, mice and rats were sealed underground like a treasure during that time of calamity. The snow, the wintry blast and my thin cotton garment fought against each other on the white mountain. The snow as it fell on me, melted into a stream, the roaring blast was broken against the thin cotton robe which enclosed fiery warmth, the life and death struggle of the fighter could there be seen and die. Having won the victory, left a landmark for the hermits demonstrating the great virtue of Tamo. Mylarspa describes his impressions as a poet, but accepting the fact that he was shut up unexpectedly in the snows, without sufficient provisions and a proper shelter, there is nothing exceptional in his experience. Many Tibetan hermits spend the winter in surroundings resembling those that he depicts.